This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 213 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I wanted to open up today's mailbag show with a question that I got from at Zachary C. Picker on Twitter. It says, I heard some people describing the Pats victory as a victory over analytics because they ran the ball so many times on first down. But it worked. And isn't analytics just about figuring out what works and doing that? I think we're making a mistake if we're taking what happens in a single elimination playoff and drawing strong conclusions. It's amazing what happens to narratives based solely on the outcome of games. The Patriots won that game and they deserve to win that game. They outcoached the Chiefs. But if D4 doesn't line up offsides, do you know what we're hearing from talking heads this week? We're hearing how Tom Brady threw three interceptions in an AFC championship game and that his run is over. Instead, the talk surrounds Bill Belichick's genius and how New England won the football game by running the football. And they did that in a pass-heavy era. This is exactly why I'm not a big fan of saying, look at the Super Bowl teams from the last X number of years and look at these common trends among these teams. I mean, so many things happen in a given game that could so easily force an outcome to go the other way. Last year, the Saints would have played in the NFC Championship had Stephon Diggs not made a miracle play. I'm not saying the Saints would have easily beaten the Eagles. I don't think they would have beaten the Eagles. But you have no idea how that would have changed the outcome of anything. And as a result, we use the Eagles in our Super Bowl sample, even though it could have been another team. And you can go back in almost any playoff and do the same thing. That's no different this year. We'll look at the Rams and Patriots and say, here's what they did to make the Super Bowl. But both of those teams were one play away from not being in the Super Bowl. So I don't think one single game should be a win or a loss for analytics. I think multiple games can be a win or a loss, and I think that we can look at the Eagles and what they did last year and feel good about the role that analytics played. But New England just attacked a weakness last weekend. They went after a defense that had struggled against the run. But I think what's being overlooked in what New England did is that replicating their performance is a very difficult thing for another team to do. A big reason numbers-driven people want teams to stop focusing so much on the run is because it's less efficient than throwing the football. You can see that in literally any expected points formula. You can see that with any metric. And it's not that running can never work. It's that when teams aren't strategic with how they run, it's just a really ineffective thing to do. The Rams are a good running team because they understand how to spread a defense out and create running lanes for their running backs. Other teams who want to be run first are just imposing their will and running into stacked boxes over and over again. But with New England this past weekend, they not only were exploiting a weakness, but they did something that other teams just can't do. They ran the ball on early downs and they were pretty successful doing it, but they were also incredibly strong at converting third downs and extending drives. In other words, to dismiss Tom Brady's role in all of this is really, really foolish. The Patriots were 13 for 19 on third down in that game. They converted 68% of their third down plays. In the regular season, that number was 41% for New England. No team had even a 50% conversion rate in the regular season. Against Kansas City, Tom Brady had a 61% success rate. That means 61% of his dropbacks resulted in a positive expected points play. During the regular season, according to NumberFire's expected points model, Drew Brees had a 57% success rate and Patrick Mahomes was at 53%. Brees' success rate mark was actually historic this year. Since the year 2000, only Tom Brady's 2007 and Peyton Manning's 2004 saw a higher success rate with a minimum of 200 dropbacks. And Tom Brady was better than all of those examples in this AFC Championship game. So if you want to talk about analytics, I don't know how you say the Patriots won that game simply because they were able to run the football and how they handled early downs by running the rock. You have to recognize that they were able to actually sustain drives because of Tom Brady. But in the end, analytics aren't just about rushing and passing, and that was noted in this question. Analytics is about extracting information from data and using that information to make decisions. If someone thinks the Patriots aren't part of team analytics, then they haven't watched Bill Belichick's teams exploit opposing team weaknesses over the last two decades. If someone's trying to sell it that way, they have no idea what the Patriots are about and how they've sustained excellence. We've got plenty more questions on today's show, so let's do it to it. This first question is from @CamMcIntosh19. Who's your way too early favorite fantasy quarterback you want to target late in drafts next year? So average draft positions are going to change wildly. But I would assume that I'm going to have a whole lot of Jameis Winston next year. The Buccaneers quarterbacks in 2018 as a team scored the second most fantasy points per game in the league. Only Kansas City had a better rate. And now the Bucs have a head coach who's all about the vertical passing attack, and we know the team has good weapons at wide receiver and tight end. Winston right now is QB14 on fantasyfootballcalculator.com. I will take him there all day long. This next question is from @postgameIQ. Who will be a more valuable receiver next year, AJ Green or Amari Cooper? I'm probably going to go with AJ Green here because his target numbers are going to project higher than Amari Cooper's. You've got a coaching change coming in Cincinnati as well, so there's a little bit of upside there. But I can't really fault anyone if they want to go Amari in that situation. He saw a nice target share when he moved to Dallas, and he was a wide receiver one in points per game after that trade. But I do think that you're bound to see a little less weekly volatility with AJ Green than Amari Cooper. This next question says, does James Conner draft value decrease if AB leaves town? And then it also says, most exciting team for AB to realistically go to? I don't think James Conner's value necessarily decreases because the offense would likely become a little bit more run-heavy. I mean, the offense should be more run-heavy next season just based on simple regression. The Steelers were the most pass-heavy team in neutral game scripts and in overall pass-to-rush attempt ratio last year. When projecting for 2019, we shouldn't just project them to throw twice as many times as they ran it. It's likely to be lower. I think the biggest issue for Conner next year will be people not realizing that there should be some slight touchdown regression, and then also Jalen Samuels. Jalen Samuels exists. I know this Tomlin era has seen workhorse backs in Pittsburgh, but I have a hard time thinking that Jalen Samuels won't be involved in that offense when everyone's entirely healthy next year. And as far as the most exciting team for AB to realistically go to, I think it's San Francisco. He'll walk into a lot of targets, and he'll have a good quarterback throwing him the ball. It's a pretty good spot for him. This next question is an email. It says, "Hi JJ, big fan. I believe one thing 2018 showed us is how much running back production is dependent upon their team, whether it's their O-line, scheme, script, coach, etc. How do we effectively evaluate a team's running back floor / ceiling in the offseason? Thanks, Cecil in Denver." I would say that what you noted in the question itself is how you're trying to evaluate a team's running back floor and ceiling. You're looking at offensive line changes, you're looking at what game script could look like for this team, what the team's play caller and coach wants to do, and so on. I think generally speaking, we know at least a handful of teams who should be above average rushing attacks next year from a fantasy standpoint. The problem is that some of them already have top tier running backs on their team. So you're not going to get any sort of breakout running back discount from those particular teams, like Pittsburgh. So I'd say one thing that you can do here is also look at the quarterback situation of that team, since we know that good quarterbacks will lead good offenses, and good offenses produce good fantasy running backs. This is the reason Aaron Jones was a more obvious late round pick last year, and basically any cheap New England running back that you can get each year is generally a good bet. But there are a lot of inputs that go into this. I don't think it's a simple thing to solve because there's not a whole lot of correlation between offensive line play year over year. And so much can change throughout an organization and an offense to make predicting these situations really, really difficult. And really, I think it could just be a case of knowing which backfields to avoid more than which backfields to target. Just push out the bottom-tiered offenses from your consideration set, and then just be open to some of the middle-tiered offenses making a jump to more of the elite tier. A good example of an offense you should have been fading this past season, I talked about this on my show last week, was LeSean McCoy and that Buffalo Bills offense. So I'm sorry that it's not a really good answer, but it's one of those questions where it's impossible to have a one-size-fits-all answer. This next one's from @CornveliusDan. What's your take on no calls and when to actually be upset about them? Should when they happen in the game play much of a role in the discussion? Yeah, I mean, realistically, there are missed pass interference calls all the time. It's just that we generally don't see such egregious misses on such a big stage like we saw at the Rams and Saints game. I've always been of the belief that refs don't decide games because teams generally have time to make up for a bad call. And not only that, but a lot of bad calls are subjectively bad. But the call in the Rams Saints game was objectively bad. And considering the win probability swing that came from it, I'm totally cool with people who think it cost them the game, because it did. The game would have basically been over otherwise. If they call pass interference there, the Saints win. So I think that's my overall take. It's that when these no calls happen, or a bad call happens in general, it does matter because there's less time to make up for it as a team. Or in the Saints' case, it's the difference between having to fight for a victory and having like 70% odds to win that game, or just winning, or just having that game. And that matters. This next question is from @RLTom9. Will Ronald Jones be a piece of the Arians offense? I think there's definitely a possibility of him being a thing, but I also didn't like him a whole lot as a prospect, so in this case, I'm not going out and trying to trade for him right now. If I miss on Ronald Jones because of the coaching change, I can live with it because, again, he didn't have a very complete profile coming out of college. And there's no guarantee that Arians is going to fix him and want to use him either. Do I think it's a good coach for him? Yeah, I think the Tampa Bay offense could be pretty fun moving forward. So if they like what they see in Jones, he could be fine. From a dynasty standpoint, though, I'm not going to buy into Ronald Jones because I'm not that much of a believer. In redraft, we'll learn plenty more as the offseason goes on, so you can ask me again how I feel in July. This next question is an email from Mike. It says, in my home league, we keep three players each season. In my mind, I feel I should approach the draft in this league more with redraft strategies overall versus dynasty aspects. Would you agree with this? At what point, i.e. how many players would you have to keep each season, would you consider changing to more dynasty-centric strategy? Realistically, my approach to redraft and dynasty don't differ dramatically. Or I should say, the way I view the two from a draft strategy standpoint isn't as drastically different compared to most players. Because in redraft leagues, I'm still drafting younger players who have an opportunity to break out. It's not like I'm avoiding unproven players. Because that goes hand in hand with age, right? Unproven guys haven't been in the league for a while. So when you're throwing darts late in drafts, you're really just targeting young players that you'd like to see break out. I don't know if there's a number of keepers in which I would say, well, now this is a dynasty league, so I'll draft differently. But if you're talking about keeping three players, I would be cognizant of it, but I wouldn't drastically change my approach because of it. Especially if you're keeping players at their draft cost, because again, you're getting those young breakout players late in your draft anyway. This next question is from @BurpeeStevens. If the Chiefs don't add a running back before day three of the draft or in free agency, how do you value Damian Williams next season? I think he'll be a pretty solid RB2 if that's the case. And plenty will be said about his potential to be an RB1 as well, given what he's done down the stretch. But I'll generally take a safer route with backs who don't have a super good resume, because a lot can change quickly for those players. And we saw that this season in fantasy football. Whether it be Alex Collins or maybe Kenyon Drake, we saw that this year. But you have to love his situation and how he performed when Kareem Hunt left that team. And like I said on the show a couple of weeks back, if I'm the Chiefs, I'm probably not drafting a running back until day three. This last question is from @FakeCousin_Josh. As a crushed Bears fan, in real football, do kickers matter? Or do we suffer from seeing someone miss with the game on the line and think it's important? Yeah, of course they matter. If they didn't matter, then we wouldn't see large discrepancies in an expected points model. But we do. If you're missing extra points and easy field goals, then you're swinging win probability in a negative way, and that's going to impact things. That's going to hurt a team. I think we saw that firsthand with Chris Boswell and the Steelers this year. But yes, kickers absolutely matter. But that doesn't mean that you should just go spend money on one or spend a high draft pick on one. Because a lot of times, these good kickers can come from nowhere. But as a position on a football field, they absolutely matter. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to all of you guys for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. And I'm also on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. You can send your mailbag questions to that account or email me at jj@numberfire.com. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.